Joining me right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline, is the head basketball coach at George Mason, Tony Skin. His first season in Fairfax at his alma mater was a good one. Mason won 20 games last year, and they won at home over a top 25 team for the first time in program history. I would have thought that they would have done that with one of the teams that Tony played on under Jim Larinaga, but they beat 16th-ranked Dayton last year, had an excellent season, and of course, many of you remember Tony Skin as a significant part of the 2006 Mason team that made that incredible run to the Final Four. But Coach was also an Olympian back in 2012 in London, representing Nigeria, the country in which he was born. It was the first Olympics for Nigeria. Coach, thanks. I really appreciate you making time and doing this for me.
No, absolutely. I appreciate you guys taking the time to have me on.
You know, I was thinking about Nigeria the first time they were in the Olympics was 2012. Did Hakeem just not play international ball? I mean, I would have thought one of the Olajuwon teams would have qualified for the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds good, right? I believe Hakeem Olajuwon actually played for Team USA, did he not?
I think he ended up doing that, but I'm talking about when he was, you know, in college at Houston and maybe when he was a younger player. He didn't ever represent Nigeria internationally. You might be right.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, I'm not that old, so out of my jurisdiction. But you know, I'm sure that you know, our federation is always evolving. You know, year to year, Olympics to Olympic, you know, international competition to competition, and so. I would imagine probably back in the 80s when Hakeem was, you know, on his rise, I would imagine that the federation just wasn't quite there yet. You know, the foundation of our country when it comes to basketball, there's a lot of American Nigerians. And so that's the one reason why you've just kind of seen the growth of Nigerian basketball because of that dynamic.
Most famous Nigerian athlete of all time, Olajuwon or Christian Okoye?
Hakeem Olajuwon, not even close.
Yeah, that's what I would think. Before we get to talking about the Olympics and you know, the U.S. won yesterday, so they're 2-0 in group stage. Tell me about your team. What do you have coming back? Who do you have coming in? What's George Mason going to be in the A-10 in 2024-2025?
Yeah, honestly, I think we're going to have a chance to be a lot tougher. We're going to have a chance to be a lot deeper. You know, we've got a pretty big team. We return, you know, Darius Faddix, who averaged over 14 points a game, was top 10 in the country in 3-point field goal percentage. You know, he's one of those guys that, you know, if he's not first team preseason all A-10, then, you know, the league better be damn good. He's a tremendous young man and, you know, a leader that I think he'll step up to be one of the better players, not only in our league, but in the country. Jared Billups, you know, he's the guy that wins. Doesn't always get the stats to show it after the game, but he wins the hard hat award. He was a big piece of us getting our 20th win against Richmond at the end of the season. And obviously, you know, Richmond was the best team in our league, and we kind of had our backs against the wall with some injuries down the stretch. And you know, Jared Billups went out there and just basically played incredible defense on Jordan King, who was league MVP, and shut him down to 2 points. And so his leadership, his physicality, his defensive mindset. You know, having that in your backyard for another year is going to help us. We also bring back Woody Newton, who was a big piece for us last year down the stretch, versatile, kind of a 3-4 that can do a little bit of everything. We bring back Austin Ball, who stepped up and won some games for us as a freshman. We have the big fella, Jalen Haynes, who actually sat out last year, who's got a chance to be, I think, one of the better combo forwards in our league. You know, he's a 15-point, 9-point scorer at East Tennessee State before he transferred over to us. And then we bring in some pretty good pieces. Katie Johnson, who started, you know, over 100 games in the SEC. You know, he's one of those competitors that, you know, you love him when he's on your team and you hate him when he's not. Right. He just brings that overall experience. Zach Anderson, who's another piece that I'm really excited about with his ability to shoot the basketball, his ability to be able to play with a lot of freedom, but also know how to play within the team. He shot over 45% from three last year. I'm still not sure why he didn't get more touches. So I'm excited about him, especially at that four spot. We've got a big Nigerian kid that came over from Siena, just a big, you know, physical 6'10". He's as physical looking as you, as you're going to get in college basketball. He probably belongs in the Big Ten more than the A-10. You know, he's dynamic. He's athletic. He's a rim protector. Braden O'Connor, who I'm excited about at the combo position, you know, can play a little bit of both guard spots, spent some time at UMass Lowell. He's tough. He's a defender, you know, offensive minded, but also can guard as well. Wants to guard. Jaquan Quinterly from Iona, you know, another guard that averaged 14 points a game and, you know, four assists, really got going down the stretch for Iona, a local kid that's going to be, you know, he's going to have a chance to play some point for us. And then, you know, I can't leave out the freshmen, you know, Justin Begg and Bryson Coakley, who showed that, you know, they're going to have a chance to compete for some minutes here. And so we've got a pretty strong foundation coming back from last year, but there's some key pieces that I think can help us, you know, with our versatility, but also with our depth.
Wow. You know, what you just described, when you started to go through the players that are transferring into Mason, and I just read that your transfer class is top 50 in the nation. Yep. You understand this. You coached, you know, you were at Maryland with Kevin Willard. You were at Seton Hall with Kevin Willard. You were at Ohio State as an assistant before you became the head coach at Mason last year. You understand better than anybody does, you know, the challenges of a George Mason in the Atlantic 10. It's, you know, re-recruiting your own, and you're able to keep that one key player that you talked about, that Darius Maddox. And I would have imagined that he would have been sought after. Mason and the A-10 schools, right, typically are the schools that lose these players to NIL and to transfer pool. How have you been able to keep your best player there and then get a top 50 transfer class coming in?
I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, the A-10 has a couple problems. No one wants to play us schedule-wise, but then everyone wants to come pick apart our players. And
right.
So, you know, it's one of those things where you could be a role player in the A-10, put up some solid numbers, not great. You know, somebody, you jump in the portal, someone in the Power 5 is going to come grab you because the league is respected. And retention is something that we're going to always struggle with. I think that's something that regardless of the level, regardless of the conference, if you play well, you know, you're probably better suited in the portal if it's a financial decision. If you don't play well, you're probably going to go in the portal and get another opportunity. And so I'm one of those coaches. I'm not complaining about it. This is just the way it is. We've got to be able to adapt to it as coaches. I think that, you know, one of the reasons why we've been successful is the staff that I've put together, just a bunch of hungry guys that just really know how to build those relationships if they're not, you know, already existing relationships. I think we've got a little bit of a cheat code here in the DMV just because we're so familiar with so many of these kids in different ways, whether it's through friends that coach high school programs or AAU programs, or whether it's kids that we recruited, you know, on the front end that ends up coming back to us on the back end. Darius Maddox is an example. I recruited him when I was at Seton Hall. When I got the job here, you know, he was like, "Coach, I'm coming to George Mason." I barely recruited him. But again, those type of relationships, those type of kids and their families, you know, that's a big reason why we were able to retain a couple guys that I think, you know, if they would have went in that portal, you know, they would have gotten, you know, they would have gotten some money. And Darius Maddox, knowing kind of just what's on the other side, a guy that, you know, he's played at the high major level. He spent some time at Virginia Tech, and he was successful there. Knowing that he made that jump in his development, that's something that he wasn't willing to risk. And so it doesn't happen all the time. I'm just happy that it happened for us in year two.
You know, you've been around here for a long time. I mean, you went to high school locally at Tacoma Academy. I'm assuming that was the Tacoma Academy that existed on University Boulevard, right? In Tacoma?
I'm sorry, I missed you on that one.
You went to Tacoma Academy. You grew up here. You know, you came to the U.S., you were 2 years old. I said that Tacoma Academy, which moved around, that you probably played for when it was on University Boulevard, right?
So it's always been on Carroll Avenue, right off of University Boulevard.
Right off, yeah, that's so, what I meant.
Yeah, right off of University Boulevard. Yeah, played at Tacoma Academy.
Yeah, so you're so familiar with the DMV and the kind of basketball town that we have. I mean, you were, I think, part of Team Takeover there for a couple of years. Do you ever, I mean, you do leave and you do recruit. What you've recruited it, you've played in it. What is it compared to the rest of the country? Is this the best, you know, youth basketball, high school basketball in the nation?
I honestly, I'm going to be biased, and I hope none of my non-DMV people are listening to this call. But no, I'm biased, and I think the DMV does have, and it's proven. You know, if you look at the last couple of national championships, if you go back a decade, I want to say 8 or 9 of those teams, with the exception of that Baylor team that won during COVID, you know, the Villanova teams, the UConn teams, there's been a guy from the D.C. area on each roster. Right. And I think that tells you a little bit of what you have to know. A lot of coaches hire, they hire coaches from this area because they want in the DMV. And again, it's not fair just because we've got such a large population and one small demographic. But to say the least, you know, being able to play in the BCL, being able to play, you know, in the WCAC, where, you know, at some other, you know, areas and some other demographics, you might get 2 or 3 really strong games because you're playing out of your league or out of your city. The WCAC, you know, the BCL, even some of the public school leagues in the DMV, it doesn't allow a night off. You're playing against really, really good programs. You're playing against really well-coached programs. And I think that just helps our guys when they do get to college and the success that they find.
I thought the PVI team from last year, the Paul the Sixth team, was one of the best high school teams I've ever seen. How much of them did you get to see?
This past year or the year before? Because they've been pretty damn good the last...
They were. I thought this year, I mean, they had... I mean, it was 4 or 5-star guys, right? 3 5-stars, 6 4-star guys. I don't know if I've ever seen a roster high school-wise, yeah, other than a basketball academy that loaded.
Yeah, yeah. Now you know how I felt when I was at Maryland for the 1 year. I was trying to figure out who the hell I wanted to recruit, because that team was pretty much the same thing. You know, you had, you know, the big fella going to Duke. You had Darren Harris going to Duke. You got, yep, you know, Deshaun Harris-Smith, who I recruited to Maryland. And then a few other guys. And so, I mean, you know, Coach Glenn Farrell over there, he's done a phenomenal job.
Great job.
Over the last couple of years, man, and getting those guys to Paul the Sixth, you know, a program that when I was coming up, yeah, they were in the WCAC, but nobody really paid attention to him. And he's just done such a phenomenal job. And, you know, I wish they were still in our backyard, because they literally, you know, used to be 0.5 miles away, but then they moved out to Loudoun County, so they're a little, yeah, bit further out. But, you know, you talk about a program that's been, you know, very dominant over the last couple of years, and he's still got continue to develop as well.
Yeah, we got you back. We lost you there for a second. All right, let's talk some Olympic basketball. Steve Kerr's got quite a – talking about a loaded squad. The U.S. is loaded. Is there – give me a team that you think even has a shot of winning gold instead of the U.S.?
Honestly, and this is probably shouldn't say this. I've been so locked in with my team. The first chance that I actually got to watch any of those games was yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, the South Sudan and Team USA team. I know a few teams that are in the Olympics, but I haven't paid enough attention to know who's going to give them a fight. To be honest with you, I don't see it happening. I think this is as dominant as it gets. I think they're figuring, you know, they're trying to figure some things out, just because, you know, they are. You know, at the end of the day, it's the dream team. Everyone's going to give them their best, and I think that they know that. And so you've got a bunch of different guys that are going to be able to step up, and, you know, as you're seeing, different guys that play, different guys that don't. And I'd hate to be Steve Kerr right now, because that might be the best basketball problem to have in the world right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you got 12 guys, and he's not playing 2 of them every night. And there was the big controversy over the first game of Jason Tatum not even playing. Because you played internationally for Nigeria and played in the Olympics, what is the international opinion, if you feel like you understand that sentiment, of the U.S. team now? Because internationally, obviously, the game's grown so much, and the competitive level is much different than it was with the 92 Dream Team, obviously. But what is the feeling when you get into these international competitions and the U.S. is in it?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, you know, you talk about the grassroots here in the States versus, you know, I guess you can say the counter of the grassroots overseas. A lot of these guys, a lot of these kids, they're playing with a professional mindset at such a young age. You know, there is no college. And so when you come up with some of these grassroots teams and the farm teams, you're playing at 12 and 13, you're playing against pros, you know, 15, 16, you're playing against pros. I remember my run playing overseas, playing the 7 or 8 years I played. There was always one or two young guys that practiced with us every day. They didn't get in games, but you're talking 14, 15-year-olds. I'll use Dennis Schroeder as an example. When I played in Germany on Braunschweig Phantoms, he was on the second division team, but he was practicing with us, and essentially he was, you know, the third point guard. I knew then he was going to be a pro because of how hard he played and how well he understood the game. And so it's not a surprise to me that now, you know, 10, 11, 12 years later, he's a professional playing at the highest level. And so I would just say the mindset of how serious the players take the game. It's not so much a red carpet. It's not so much a silver spoon. They don't go through, you know, the AAU process where they're given shoes. I mean, some of these guys are essentially playing professionally and playing for free.
Right.
And if that doesn't motivate you to play at the highest level, you know, I don't know what does. And so when you have that dynamic, you know, years later of a bunch of guys that went through that are now playing at the international level, you know, representing their countries, you're going to get some damn good basketball players that understand the game. They might not be as athletic, but they really, really understand the game. And, you know, the international game just gets a little bit more complicated for those NBA guys, because that's not the type of competition, you know, different schemes that they're seeing for, you know, 90 to 100 games.
George Mason basketball coach Tony Skin joining us courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline. Bet smarter, beat the books. Download the BetQL app today or visit BetQL.com. You know, when you were mentioning your international career, and I just looked it up, it looks like you played in four or five different countries minimum. I'm always fascinated by guys like you, you know, because internationally, you got a chance, and I'll have you describe the countries that you lived in. You just had a completely different life experience than you would have had you been in the NBA. Now, the compensation was different as well, but I'm wondering, you know, now that you are, you know, you're a coach and you're older, do you look back on that as an incredible experience? And if you could just share with us, you know, where you played and for how long?
Yeah, no, I 1,000% I look at it as an experience that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world, not a single dollar. You know, having a chance to learn just different places, learn different cultures. I mean, my first year, it was a rough one. And you hear of some of these horror stories. And for the most part of my career, I was fortunate enough to where I didn't really have that. It was pretty smooth, but my first year was pretty rough. You know, I ended up going overseas, going to France. I got there late, you know, because my son was being born on the day that they wanted me to come to training camp. And I'm 170 pounds soaking wet, 6 foot. I don't need 3 weeks to get in shape. And right. So I showed up to training camp, you know, 3 or 4 days late. That didn't impress the staff. And 3 weeks later, you know, I was sent home. And then I had another chance to go back to Croatia with KK Split, a pretty famous team that has had some really big time guys, you know, Vlade Divac, Tony Kukoc. That's the team that in the program those guys came from. But then I was playing for free for, you know, a month and a half. So I had to leave there. And so this is all happening within, you know, 3 or 4 months. And that light bulb and that tunnel starts to close. And you start to think, is this really what, you know, European basketball is about? And then I got my next opportunity to go back to France. And I did well. Played for a coach who took a chance on me towards the end of my first year. End up doing really, really well and spent, you know, 3 years in France as one of the top five scorers. And, you know, I loved it in France. And, you know, my time was kind of up and I played myself into the Italian league, which I would say is probably my favorite. It's probably my favorite year in competition just because the Italian culture, the league is well respected.
Where were you living? Was it in Rome or were you in Tuscany? Where were you?
So I was in Tuscany. I was in Pistoia, okay. which is really, you know, right in between Pisa in Florence. I was smack dab in the middle. If I drove 30 minutes to one way, I'd be at Pisa. 30 minutes the other way, I was in Florence. And so that was by far my favorite year and some change. I then went on to play in Germany in Braunschweig, which is, you know, pretty much central, you know, central Germany. And then played also in Israel and, you know, obviously played in the Olympics and was on my way to the Ukraine until I got injured, which, you know, essentially was the end of my career with a bad injury, and then got into coaching. And so I've had some stops, man, and I would say just that experience alone, you know, I tell people all the time, man, I'd rather go to Europe than to go anywhere else in the States, to be honest with you, because I enjoyed it. I learned a lot, built some relationships, and it's actually helped me now as a coach, because some of those relationships come back full circle and you end up recruiting somebody, talking to a coach that you played with or played against. And so those things have helped me tremendously as a coach, and I'm probably not sitting here as the head coach at George Mason if I don't go through those experiences.
Yeah, I think that's incredible. And, you know, probably somebody you even maybe have coached with, Darren McClinton, who's a friend of mine, had that long international career as well, and had all those stories about, you know, the language issues and, you know, living conditions. And, you know, some places were great, some places were really rough.
I got a story. But
I got a story for you.
I got a story for you. Darren McClinton is actually like one of my big brothers.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day when I was running around the gym and getting kicked out of the gym because I wasn't good enough, you know, Darren McClinton, you know, Steve Francis, the Jason Mascaris, those guys were all in the gym. And so Darren ended up just kind of being my big brother. And the irony behind that is my first professional game when I was in Croatia was against Darren. He was playing in Bosnia. I was playing in Croatia. And I say this all the time. I joke around. I had a triple-double on Darren McClinton, except the triple-double was 12 turnovers.
Yeah,
that's hilarious.
Yeah, not the kind you want, but still an incredible experience. By the way, can you believe that we're coming up on 18 years? Actually, it'll be 19 years since the run to the Final Four. Do you guys still stay in touch? Do you get together with Coach Larrañaga? I mean, tell me about sort of the relationships from, you know, that team with all of those players.
Yeah, I mean, when you do something like that, when you do something so special like that, you don't lose contact. You know, I've always been in contact with Coach Larrañaga. You know, he's been instrumental in, you know, just kind of my my journey through coaching. I actually spent some time in Florida. Back in June, I went to go have lunch with Coach Larrañaga. And so I'm always, you know, in contact with him. And then our group in general, we've got a Final Four chat that's 18 years old. And, you know, it's safe to say that we're still going at it in that group chat about different things 18 years later. But it's a very, very close-knit. I've got Lamar Butler, who obviously was my backcourt teammate. He's on staff here at the player development. You know, Fowler Campbell is still around. And John Vaughn is, you know, he's big man on campus doing some different things at the university. And so we're still a very, very close group. Tim Burns, who's now one of the better trainers in the country in the New York City area. You know, he's a guy that I've relied on from a basketball standpoint over the last couple of years, my times at Seton Hall. And so our group was special then, and it's still pretty special.
Of those games, and we won't talk about the first one, but of the games, you know, Carolina, Wichita, the games at the Verizon Center, I was at both of those. The atmosphere was insane. You know, by the way, Mark Turgeon coached that Wichita State team that you beat.
Sure
and
did.
Then the UConn game. What was is the UConn game the most memorable of all of them?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's what got us to, you know, the Final Four, essentially, against a, you know, arguably one of the better teams in basketball in the last 20 years. You know, you're talking four first-round draft picks, a team that was ranked number one for as many consecutive weeks as you can as you can count college basketball. People forget that. You know, going up against Giants, man, and having the opportunity to beat them for 39 minutes and, you know, 57 seconds. And, you know, unfortunately, the best free throw shooter misses the free throw. They tie it up and it goes into OT. And having to walk back to that bench, man, it was probably the longest walk in my life just because I knew I could have, you know, I could have iced the game. And, you know, a team like that, you don't beat them in an extra 5 minutes. You got to beat them in the first 40 minutes. And, you know, being able to just overcome that, it was a significant game. It was in our backyard. And obviously, you know, I'm just glad to be a part of it.
What was the story? I think I read this. You'll remember it. That Larrañaga, who was a hell of a communicator and motivator, basically, and I don't even know if it was true, said that UConn had no idea what conference you guys even played in.
Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes my memory gets a little distorted.
It's all right.
You hear a lot of stories that come from Jim Larranaga. He's a big-time storyteller.
Yeah.
He tells more stories in a day than I can't remember who. But I do remember just being in the locker room, and, you know, I think it was one of those things where one of the coaches played a clip of one of the players basically, you know, being asked a question about us, you know, who we were, what league we played in. And I can't remember who it was, but they answered it. They didn't really know. It was information that wasn't on the scout report. And, you know, Coach Larranaga just kind of used that as motivation. He wrote, you know, CAA on the board, but he didn't put, you know, CAA, the Colonial Athletic Association. He put the Connecticut Assassination Association.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, he's a genius when it comes to keeping it fun, but also understanding what the message and what the goal is.
Really appreciate the time. Enjoyed it. Best of luck on the upcoming season. Maybe we can talk as we get closer to that.
No, absolutely. Appreciate you guys for having me on.
Tony Skin, the head coach at George Mason. Denton wants to talk some college football. He has a favorite team heading into the 2024 season. And Dan Quinn said something about competition earlier this morning that we'll play for you as well. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com. Joining me right now, courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline, is the head basketball coach at George Mason, Tony Skin. His first season in Fairfax at his alma mater was a good one. Mason won 20 games last year, and they won at home over a top 25 team for the first time in program history. I would have thought that they would have done that with one of the teams that Tony played on under Jim Larranaga, but they beat 16th-ranked Dayton last year, had an excellent season, and of course, many of you remember Tony Skin as a significant part of the 2006 Mason team that made that incredible run to the Final Four. But Coach was also an Olympian back in 2012 in London, representing Nigeria, the country in which he was born. It was the first Olympics for Nigeria. Coach, thanks. I really appreciate you making time and doing this for me.
No, absolutely. I appreciate you guys taking the time to have me on.
You know, I was thinking about Nigeria the first time they were in the Olympics was 2012. Did Hakeem just not play international ball? I mean, I would have thought one of the Olajuwon teams would have qualified for the Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds good, right? I believe Hakeem Olajuwon actually played for Team USA, did he not?
I think he ended up doing that, but I'm talking about when he was, you know, in college at Houston and maybe when he was a younger player. He didn't ever represent Nigeria internationally. You might be right.
Yeah, no, that's, you know, I'm not that old, so out of my jurisdiction, but, you know, I'm sure that you know, our federation is always evolving, you know, year to year, Olympic to Olympic, you know, international competition to competition, and so I would imagine probably back in the 80s when Hakeem was, you know, on his rise, I would imagine that the federation just wasn't quite there yet. You know, the foundation of our country when it comes to basketball, there's a lot of American Nigerians. And so that's the one reason why you've just kind of seen the growth of Nigerian basketball because of that dynamic.
Most famous Nigerian athlete of all time, Olajuwon or Christian Okoye?
Hakeem Olajuwon, not even close.
Yeah, that's what I would think. Before we get to talking about the Olympics and you know, the U.S. won yesterday, so they're 2-0 in group stage. Tell me about your team. What do you have coming back? Who do you have coming in? What's George Mason going to be in the A-10 in 2024-2025?
Yeah, honestly, I think we're going to have a chance to be a lot tougher. We're going to have a chance to be a lot deeper. You know, we've got a pretty big team. We return, you know, Darius Faddix, who averaged over 14 points a game, was top 10 in the country in 3-point field goal percentage. You know, he's one of those guys that, you know, if he's not first team preseason all A-10, then, you know, the league better be damn good. He's a tremendous young man and, you know, a leader that I think he'll step up to be one of the better players, not only in our league, but in the country. Jared Billups, you know, he's the guy that wins. Doesn't always get the stats to show it after the game, but he wins the Hard Hat Award. He was a big piece of us getting our 20th win against Richmond at the end of the season. And obviously, you know, Richmond was the best team in our league, and we kind of had our backs against the wall with some injuries down the stretch. And, you know, Jared Billups went out there and just basically played incredible defense on Jordan King, who was league MVP, and shut him down to 2 points. And so his leadership, his physicality, his defensive mindset, you know, having that in your backyard for another year is going to help us. We also bring back Woody Newton, who was a big piece for us last year down the stretch, versatile, kind of a 3-4 that can do a little bit of everything. We bring back Austin Ball, who stepped up and won some games for us as a freshman. We have the big fella, Jalen Haynes, who actually sat out last year, who's got a chance to be, I think, one of the better combo forwards in our league. You know, he's a 15-point, 9-point scorer at East Tennessee State before he transferred over to us. And then we bring in some pretty good pieces. Katie Johnson, who started, you know, over 100 games in the SEC. You know, he's one of those competitors that, you know, you love him when he's on your team and you hate him when he's not. Right. Just brings that overall experience. Zach Anderson, who's another piece that I'm really excited about with his ability to shoot the basketball, his ability to be able to play with a lot of freedom, but also know how to play within the team. He shot over 45% from three last year. I'm still not sure why he didn't get more touches. So I'm excited about him, especially at that four spot. We've got a big Nigerian kid that came over from Siena, just a big, you know, physical 6'10". He's as physical looking as you're going to get in college basketball. He probably belongs in the Big Ten more than the A-10. You know, he's dynamic. He's athletic. He's a rim protector. Braden O'Connor, who I'm excited about at the combo position, you know, can play a little bit of both guard spots, spent some time at UMass Lowell. He's tough. He's a defender, you know, offensive minded, but also can guard as well. Wants to guard. Jaquan Quinterly from Iona, you know, another guard that averaged 14 points a game and, you know, 4 assists, really got going down the stretch for Iona, a local kid that's going to be, you know, he's going to have a chance to play some point for us. And then, you know, I can't leave out the freshmen, you know, Justin Begg and Bryson Coakley, who showed that, you know, they're going to have a chance to compete for some minutes here. And so we've got a pretty strong foundation coming back from last year, but there's some key pieces that I think can help us, you know, with our versatility, but also with our depth.
Wow. You know, what you just described, when you started to go through the players that are transferring into Mason, and I just read that your transfer class is top 50 in the nation. Yep. You understand this. You coached, you know, you were at Maryland with Kevin Willard. You were at Seton Hall with Kevin Willard. You were at Ohio State as an assistant before you became the head coach at Mason last year. You understand better than anybody does, you know, the challenges of a George Mason in the Atlantic 10. It's, you know, re-recruiting your own, and you're able to keep that one key player that you talked about, that Darius Maddox. And I would have imagined that he would have been sought after. Mason and the A-10 schools, right, typically are the schools that lose these players to NIL and to transfer pool. How have you been able to keep your best player there and then get a top 50 transfer class coming in?
I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, the A-10 has a couple problems. No one wants to play us schedule-wise, but then everyone wants to come pick apart our players.
Right.
So, you know, it's one of those things where you could be a role player in the A-10, put up some solid numbers, not great. You know, somebody, you jump in the portal, someone in the Power 5 is going to come grab you because the league is respected. And retention is something that we're going to always struggle with. I think that's something that regardless of the level, regardless of the conference, if you play well, you know, you're probably better suited in the portal if it's a financial decision. If you don't play well, you're probably going to go in the portal and get another opportunity. And so, I'm one of those coaches. I'm not complaining about it. This is just the way it is. We've got to be able to adapt to it as coaches. I think that, you know, one of the reasons why we've been successful is the staff that I've put together. Just a bunch of hungry guys that just really know how to build those relationships if they're not, you know, already existing relationships. I think we've got a little bit of a cheat code here in the DMV just because we're so familiar with so many of these kids in different ways, whether it's through friends that coach high school programs or AAU programs, or whether it's kids that we recruited, you know, on the front end that ends up coming back to us on the back end. Darius Maddox is an example. I recruited him when I was at Seton Hall. When I got the job here, you know, he was like, Coach, I'm coming to George Mason. I barely recruited him. But again, those type of relationships, those type of kids and their families, you know, that's a big reason why we were able to retain a couple guys that I think, you know, if they would have went in that portal, you know, they would have gotten, you know, they would have gotten some money. And Darius Maddox, knowing kind of just what's on the other side, a guy that, you know, he's played at the high major level. He spent some time at Virginia Tech, and he was successful there. Knowing that he made that jump in his development, that's something that he wasn't willing to risk. And so it doesn't happen all the time. I'm just happy that it happened for us in year two.
You know, you've been around here for a long time. I mean, you went to high school locally at Tacoma Academy. I'm assuming that was the Tacoma Academy that existed on University Boulevard, right? In Tacoma?
I'm sorry, I missed you on that one.
You went to Tacoma Academy. You grew up here. You know, you came to the U.S., you were 2 years old. I said that Tacoma Academy, which moved around, that you probably played for when it was on University Boulevard, right?
So it's always been on Carroll Avenue, right off of University Boulevard.
Right off, yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, right off of University Boulevard. Yeah, played at Tacoma Academy.
Yeah, so you're so familiar with the DMV and the kind of basketball town that we have. I mean, you were, I think, part of Team Takeover there for a couple of years. Do you ever, I mean, you do leave and you do recruit. What you've recruited it, you've played in it. What is it compared to the rest of the country? Is this the best, you know, youth basketball, high school basketball in the nation?
I honestly, I'm going to be biased, and I hope none of my non-DMV people are listening to this call. but no, I'm biased, and I think the DMV does have, and it's proven. You know, if you look at the last couple of national championships, if you go back a decade, I want to say 8 or 9 of those teams, with the exception of that Baylor team that won during COVID, you know, the Villanova teams, the UConn teams, there's been a guy from the D.C. area on each roster. Right. And I think that tells you a little bit of what you have to know. A lot of coaches hire, they hire coaches from this area because they want in the DMV. And again, it's not fair just because we've got such a large population and one small demographic. But to say the least, you know, being able to play in the BCL, being able to play, you know, in the WCAC where, you know, at some other, you know, areas and some other demographics, you might get 2 or 3 really strong games because you're playing out of your league or out of your city. The WCAC, you know, the BCL, and even some of the public school leagues in the DMV, it doesn't allow a night off. You're playing against really, really good programs. You're playing against really well-coached programs. And I think that just helps our guys when they do get to college and the success that they find.
I thought the PVI team from last year, the Paul the Sixth team, was one of the best high school teams I've ever seen. How much of them did you get to see?
This past year or the year before? Because they've been pretty damn good the last...
They were. I thought this year, I mean, they had... I mean, it was 4 or 5-star guys, right? 3 5-stars, 6 4-star guys. I don't know if I've ever seen a roster high school-wise other than a basketball academy that loaded.
Yeah. Now you know how I felt when I was at Maryland for the 1 year. I was trying to figure out who the hell I wanted to recruit because that team was pretty much the same thing. You know, you had, you know, the big fella going to Duke. You had Darren Harris going to Duke. You got Deshaun Harris-Smith, who I recruited to Maryland, and then a few other guys. And so, I mean, you know, Coach Glenn Farrell over there, he's done a phenomenal job.
Great job.
Over the last couple of years, man, and getting those guys to Paul the Sixth, you know, program that when I was coming up, they were in the WCAC, but nobody really paid attention to him. And he's just done such a phenomenal job. And, you know, I wish they were still in our backyard because they literally, you know, used to be 0.5 miles away, but then they moved out to Loudoun County, so they're a little bit further out. But, you know, you talk about a program that's been, you know, very dominant over the last couple of years, and he's still got continue to develop as well.
Yeah, we got you back. We lost you there for a second. All right, let's talk some Olympic basketball. Steve Kerr's got quite a – talking about a loaded squad. The U.S. is loaded. Is there – give me a team that you think even has a shot of winning gold instead of the U.S.?
Honestly, and this is – probably shouldn't say this. I've been so locked in with my team. The first chance that I actually got to watch any of those games was yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, the South Sudan and Team USA team. I know a few teams that are in the Olympics, but I haven't paid enough attention to know who's going to give them a fight, to be honest with you. I don't see it happening. I think this is as dominant as it gets. I think they're figuring, you know, they're trying to figure some things out just because, you know, they are, you know, at the end of the day, it's a dream team. Everyone's going to give them their best. And I think that they know that. And so you've got a bunch of different guys that are going to be able to step up and, you know, as you're seeing different guys that play, different guys that don't. And I'd hate to be Steve Kerr right now because that might be the best basketball problem to have in the world right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you got 12 guys and he's not playing two of them every night. And there was the big controversy over the first game of Jason Tatum not even playing. Because you played internationally for Nigeria and played in the Olympics, what is the international opinion, if you feel like you understand that sentiment, of the U.S. team now? Because internationally, obviously, the game's grown so much, and the competitive level is much different than it was with the 92 Dream Team, obviously. But what is the feeling when you get into these international competitions and the U.S. is in it?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where, you know, you talk about the grassroots here in the States versus, you know, I guess you could say the counter of the grassroots overseas. A lot of these guys, a lot of these kids, they're playing with a professional mindset at such a young age. You know, there is no college. And so when you come up with some of the grassroots teams and the farm teams, you're playing at 12 and 13, you're playing against pros, you know, 15, 16, you're playing against pros. I remember my run playing overseas, playing the 7 or 8 years I played. There was always one or two young guys that practiced with us every day. They didn't get in games, but you're talking 14, 15-year-olds. I'll use Dennis Schroeder as an example. When I played in Germany on Braunschweig Phantoms, he was on the second division team, but he was practicing with us, and essentially he was, you know, the third point guard. I knew then he was going to be a pro because of how hard he played and how well he understood the game. And so it's not a surprise to me that now, you know, 10, 11, 12 years later, he's a professional playing at the highest level. And so I would just say the mindset of how serious the players take the game. It's not so much a red carpet. It's not so much a silver spoon. They don't go through, you know, the AAU process where they're given shoes. I mean, some of these guys are essentially playing professionally and playing for free.
Right.
And if that doesn't motivate you to play at the highest level, you know, I don't know what does. And so when you have that dynamic, you know, years later of a bunch of guys that went through that are now playing at the international level, you know, representing their countries, you're going to get some damn good basketball players that understand the game. They might not be as athletic, but they really, really understand the game. And, you know, the international game just gets a little bit more complicated for those NBA guys, because that's not the type of competition, you know, different schemes that they're seeing for, you know, 90 to 100 games.
George Mason basketball coach Tony Skin joining us courtesy of our BetQL guest hotline. Bet smarter, beat the books. Download the BetQL app today or visit BetQL.com. You know, when you were mentioning the your international career, and I just looked it up, it looks like you played in 4 or 5 different countries minimum. I'm always fascinated by guys like you, you know, because internationally, you got a chance, and I'll have you describe the countries that you lived in. You just had a completely different life experience than you would have had you been in the NBA. Now, the compensation was different as well, but I'm wondering, you know, now that you are, you know, you're a coach and you're older, do you look back on that as an incredible experience? And if you could just share with us, you know, where you played and for how long?
Yeah, no, I 1,000% I look at it as an experience that I wouldn't trade for anything in the world, not a single dollar. You know, having a chance to learn just different places, learn different cultures. I mean, my first year, it was a rough one. And you hear of some of these horror stories. And for the most part of my career, I was fortunate enough to where I didn't really have that. It was pretty smooth. But my first year was pretty rough. You know, I ended up going overseas, going to France. I got there late, you know, because my son was being born on the day that they wanted me to come to training camp. And I'm 170 pounds soaking wet, 6 foot. I don't need 3 weeks to get in shape. And right. So I showed up to training camp, you know, you know, 3 or 4 days late. That even, you know, didn't impress the staff. And 3 weeks later, you know, I was sent home. And then I had another chance to go back to Croatia with KK Split, a pretty famous team that has had some really big-time guys. You know, Vlade Divac, Tony Kukoc, that's the team that in the program those guys came from. But then I was playing for free for, you know, a month and a half. So I had to leave there. And so this is all happening within, you know, 3 or 4 months. And that light bulb and that tunnel starts to close. And you start to think, is this really what, you know, European basketball is about? And then I got my next opportunity to go back to France. And I did well. I played for a coach who took a chance on me towards the end of my first year. Ended up doing really, really well and spent, you know, 3 years in France as one of the top five scorers. And, you know, I loved it in France. And, you know, my time was kind of up and I played myself into the Italian league, which I would say is probably my favorite. It's probably my favorite year in competition just because the Italian culture, the league is well respected.
Where were you living? Was it in Rome or were you in Tuscany? Where were you?
So I was in Tuscany. I was in Pistoia, okay. which is really, you know, right in between Pisa and Florence. I was smack dab in the middle. If I drove 30 minutes to one way, I'd be at Pisa. 30 minutes the other way, I was in Florence. And so that was by far my favorite year and some change. I then went on to play in Germany in Braunschweig, which is, you know, pretty much central, you know, central Germany. And then played also in Israel and, you know, obviously played in the Olympics and was on my way to the Ukraine until I got injured, which, you know, essentially was the end of my career with a bad injury and then got into coaching. And so I've had some stops, man. And I would say just that experience alone, you know, I tell people all the time, man, I'd rather go to Europe than to go anywhere else in the States, to be honest with you, because I enjoyed it. I learned a lot, built some relationships, and it's actually helped me now as a coach because some of those relationships come back full circle and you end up recruiting somebody, talking to a coach that you played with or played against. And so those things have helped me tremendously as a coach, and I'm probably not sitting here as the head coach at George Mason if I don't go through those experiences.
Yeah, I think that's incredible. And, you know, probably somebody you even maybe have coached with, Darren McClinton, who's a friend of mine, had that long international career as well and had all of those stories about, you know, the language issues and, you know, living conditions. And, you know, some places were great. Some places were really rough.
I got a story for you. Darren McClinton is actually like one of my big brothers.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day when I was running around the gym and getting kicked out of the gym because I wasn't good enough, you know, Darren McClinton, you know, Steve Francis, the Jason Mascaris, those guys were all in the gym. And so Darren ended up just kind of being my big brother. And the irony behind that is my first professional game when I was in Croatia was against Darren. He was playing in Bosnia. I was playing in Croatia. And I say this all the time. I joke around. I had a triple-double on Darren McClinton, except the triple-double was 12 turnovers. that's hilarious.
Yeah, not the kind you want, but still an incredible experience. By the way, can you believe that we're coming up on 18 years? Actually, it'll be 19 years since the run to the Final Four. Do you guys still stay in touch? Do you get together with Coach Larrañaga? I mean, tell me about sort of the relationships from, you know, that team with all of those players.
Yeah, I mean, when you do something like that, when you do something so special like that, you don't lose contact. You know, I've always been in contact with Coach Larrañaga. You know, he's been instrumental in, you know, just kind of my my journey through coaching. I actually spent some time in Florida back in June. I went to go have lunch with Coach Larrañaga. And so I'm always, you know, in contact with him. And then our group in general, we've got a Final Four chat that's 18 years old. And, you know, it's safe to say that we're still going at it in that group chat about different things 18 years later. But it's a very, very close-knit. I've got Lamar Butler, who obviously was my backcourt teammate. He's on staff here at the player development. You know, Fallon Campbell is still around. And John Vaughn is, you know, he's big man on campus doing some different things at the university. And so we're still a very, very close group. Tim Burns, who's now one of the better trainers in the country in the New York City area. You know, he's a guy that I've relied on from a basketball standpoint over the last couple of years, my times at Seton Hall. And so our group was special then, and it's still pretty special.
of those games, and we won't talk about the first one, but of the games, you know, Carolina, Wichita, the games at the Verizon Center, I was at both of those. The atmosphere was insane. You know, by the way, Mark Turgeon coached that Wichita State team that you beat.
Sure
and
did.
Then the UConn game. What was the – is the UConn game the most memorable of all of them?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's what got us to, you know, the Final Four, essentially, against a, you know, arguably one of the better teams in basketball in the last 20 years. You know, you're talking four first-round draft picks, a team that was ranked number one for as many consecutive weeks as you can as you can count college basketball. People forget that. You know, going up against Giants, man, and having the opportunity to beat them for 39 minutes and, you know, 57 seconds. And, you know, unfortunately, the best free throw shooter misses the free throw. They tie it up and it goes into OT. And having to walk back to that bench, man, it was probably the longest walk in my life just because I knew I could have, you know, I could have iced the game. And, you know, a team like that, you don't beat them in an extra 5 minutes. You got to beat them in the first 40 minutes. And, you know, being able to just overcome that, it was a significant game. It was in our backyard. And obviously, you know, I'm just glad to be a part of it.
What was the story? I think I read this. You'll remember it. That Larrañaga, who was a hell of a communicator and motivator, basically, and I don't even know if it was true, said that UConn had no idea what conference you guys even played in.
Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes my memory gets a little distorted.
It's all right.
You hear a lot of stories that come from Jim Larrañaga. He's a big-time storyteller.
Yeah.
He tells more stories in the day than I can't remember who. But I do remember just being in the locker room, and, you know, I think it was one of those things where one of the coaches played a clip of one of the players basically, you know, being asked a question about us, you know, who we were, what league we played in. And I can't remember who it was, but they answered it. They didn't really know. It was information that wasn't on the scout report. And, you know, Coach Larrañaga just kind of used that as motivation. He wrote, you know, CAA on the board, but he didn't put, you know, CAA, the Colonial Athletic Association. He put the Connecticut Assassination Association.
Yeah.
So. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, he's a genius when it comes to keeping it fun, but also understanding what the message and what the goal is.
Really appreciate the time. Enjoyed it. Best of luck on the upcoming season. Maybe we can talk as we get closer to that.
No, absolutely. Appreciate you guys for having me on.
Tony Skin, the head coach at George Mason. Denton wants to talk some college football. He has a favorite team heading into the 2024 season. And Dan Quinn said something about competition earlier this morning that we'll play for you as well. Kevin Sheehan Show, the Team 980 and the Team980.com.